Okay, we have got a real treat for you today. We have an interview with the person who I believe is the most important economist in the world today. I'm not just saying that, I really believe it. This guy is the world leader in inequality, in the taxation of the super rich. I really think this guy is the guy to show to the Labour Party or whoever is in charge in your country that wealth taxes are not just some radical out there idea for like lefty tree-hugging hippies. Academics believe in this. The work is being done. The design work is being done on how, specifically how to tax the rich. I really want to show him to, you know, the political class, people like Rory Stewart on The Rest Is Politics, who has been asking, where are the academics? Where are the professors? If you want to see the academics, the professors, this is the guy. So Rory Stewart, get him on your show. You're going to get on with him like a house on fire. This is the guy we're missing, I think. The guy who really does the work. He's just had his recent book translated into English. It's called We Need to Tax Billionaires. It's a short book, it's not expensive, and it's quick to read. And it's the missing link, in my opinion. The actual, how do we do it? The specifics on how do we do it? So excited to introduce you to the most important economist in the world, Gabriel Zucman. Okay, welcome Gabriel Zucman to the United Kingdom. Thank you very much for coming, for visiting my wonderful kitchen.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for all of your work across the years on inequality on wealth taxes. And thanks for writing this book, getting it translated into English. Do you have, I don't know if you have this phrase in France, we have it in English. You wait ages for a bus and then two come along at once. Do you have a similar phrase in French? No?
No, not really.
Well, I feel a little bit like this meeting you, because the first time we met was 2 weeks ago in Paris, when I went there for the promotion of the French translation of my book. Now we're meeting again for the first time in the UK. But do you remember, you probably don't remember, do you remember roughly when the first time I ever got in touch with you by email was?
Perhaps 5-6 years ago.
I looked it up before this interview. It was the 22nd of May, 2015. So exactly 11 years ago. And I read it, it was a kind of embarrassingly long email. You were probably too busy to read it, but you very kindly replied. And then over the 11 years since then, a number of times I've reached out to you for help, for advice, where should I go to university, how should I study economics? And you replied every time. So thank you very much for all of your help across the years. And I've been following your work very, very closely, and you're obviously very well known in France now, the work you're doing now. But obviously, we're in England now, and a lot of our viewers maybe won't know who you are. So could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I'm Gabriel Zucman. I'm a professor of economics at the Paris School of Economics and the University of California in Berkeley. And I'm also the director of the International Tax Observatory. We do research on inequality and taxation with a focus on the super rich, multinational companies, tax avoidance, and how we can fix those problems. Now, these are some of the most pressing issues of our time, especially the explosion of billionaire wealth has been one of the most dramatic evolution of the world economy of the last decades. It started in the 1980s, it accelerated after the financial crisis of 2008-2009, and now there's an acceleration of the acceleration. Yeah. Over the last couple of years, if you look at the wealth of global billionaires, it has increased by 40% in just 2 years, coming on top of everything that had happened before. And with the explosion of their wealth, there's an explosion of their influence. There's an explosion of their power. And we're seeing it everywhere. And a lot, frankly, of what's happening in our democracies is downstream of this explosion of billionaire influence. And so it's frankly, it's difficult to study anything else than that at the moment. I really think it's the main economic and political issue of our time. Hence a lot of our work these days is about that.
Well, people who watch this channel will know I couldn't agree more. Obviously it's something I'm very passionate about. I'm quite interested in understanding. So I studied economics. I went to London School of Economics. We're about similar age, so I went there 2005 to 2008. Then more recently, I went to Oxford and did a master's. I'm interested in how you ended up studying economics and also studying inequality, because from my experience of economics, actually at universities, there's not a lot of discussion of inequality. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about where you're from, what was like what was life like growing up and how you ended up studying economics?
Well, I grew up in Paris. I did my studies in France. And then I got a job in the US. And so I moved to the US and I lived in Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area for about 10 years.
Okay. How old were you when you were living in San Francisco?
I moved when I was 26. It, you know, it kind of radicalized me because in the San Francisco Bay Area, you have the wealthiest people in the world. You have the tech billionaires living nearby, close to thousands, tens of thousands of homeless people in San Francisco, in Berkeley, everywhere. So tremendous, gigantic inequality. You know, I was also there when Trump got elected in 2016, and I witnessed firsthand like the failure of the Democratic Party to address the phenomenal increase in inequality in the U.S. to propose concrete, practical, and ambitious solutions to that problem. And so it led me first to kind of study inequality, especially in the U.S., but also from a global perspective, like, you know, spend all my time and energy doing that, but also progressively to try to think about, okay, you know, how should we fight it? It's good, it's important to study. And, you know, it all starts with that, you know, creating clarity, transparency, making objective the situation that exists today. It's already starting to change, you know, things a little bit, but then more recently, I kind of try to do more actionable policy work. So hence the book on, you know, how we should tax, why we need to tax billionaires, of course, but more importantly, what can we learn from the historical experience, from the international experience, and the lessons we can draw to effectively tax the billionaires today in a way that would really work.
I'm really interested in this move you've made from academia into like basically actively trying to fight inequality, because it's not an easy move to make. I want to talk a little bit about that, but before I get onto that, I just want to know a little bit about what it was like for you within academia working on and trying to work on inequality. Because, so I did a master's at Oxford 2017 to 2019, and I went there with basically the intention of working on inequality. They had one guy there who worked on inequality. I think it was Tony Atkinson. He died before I went there. He was about like 85 or something. And then there was nobody in the entire Oxford economics department working on inequality. I tried my best to choose subjects that are about inequality. I couldn't find a single one. I wrote my thesis about inequality. I couldn't find a supervisor. I had to go outside of the department. And when I was there, the general consensus was, you will not be able to succeed as an academic in academic economics if you choose inequality as your focus. So that was my experience, but you know, you, I'm aware, have been in academia much longer than me. Have things changed? Did you experience anything like that? How do you think academic economics is now with regards to being able to seriously look at inequality?
Yeah, and I think what you describe is spot on. I do think there is also some progress that's being made because, look, for a period of time, let's say after World War II, from the post-war years until the fall of the Berlin Wall, all of economics was essentially about just efficiency. You know, the debate of the time was really about whether the market economy or the planned economy is the most efficient. And inequality, distributional questions, you know, nobody cared about those issues at the time. But it was a kind of parenthesis, because economics originally, if you look at economics as it was practiced in the 19th century, if you look at the kind of the classical economists of the time, whether it's Malthus, Ricardo, Marx, Smith, you know, they were all very much interested in distributional questions. You know, what mattered for them was to understand the long-run tendencies in how income is distributed between landowners, workers, and so on. And so that's how economics used to be. There was this parenthesis during the Cold War. And after the end of the Cold War, inequality started very gradually, and it's been way too slow, but to make a comeback at the center of the economics discipline. And you mentioned Tony Atkinson, who played an incredibly important role in all of that, who was
a British economist,
who was professor at Oxford, and who was instrumental in reviving study.
I've got his book over there. You can probably in their shelf. Inequality.
His last book, exactly. Very important. And instrumental in reviving the study of the long-run trends in income and wealth concentration. And he's been an inspirational figure for me. I've known him when I was doing my PhD in Paris. You know, I met with him numerous times. And more broadly, you know, he was continuing a tradition that I feel very much a part of, which is this tradition of empirical social sciences.
Yeah, which is data-based.
Yeah, exactly. You know, which was so strong in England, in the UK for a long time. Like the inventors, for instance, of the national accounts, which are the GDP statistics, the way we quantify economic activity. Yeah. These are British economists of the 17th century, Gregory King, William Petty, and they were interested not only in measuring the economy as a whole, but also in inequality. You know, the first attempt at measuring national income, you know, by the famous social table of Gregory King, he tries to estimate the total income of England, but also the income of each social class. Yeah. Like, you know, the kings, the baronets, you know, the workers, and so on and so on. And there is this long tradition that started in the 17th century that has continued over time. Tony Atkinson was, you know, a great part of this tradition, and that I'm trying at a very modest level to continue myself with a focus on international economic relations. Okay. That's what mostly I'm interested in. And, you know, billionaires, to be honest, it's not my passion. I think it's, you know, as I said, very important to study them given everything that's happening. But deep down, most of my work has been more about the organization of international economic relations and how this changes over time and the dynamics of coordination or competition across countries, the consequences this has for inequality and so on.
So just very quickly, because I want to get onto your political work, we often get messaged by young people who want to study economics and they want to study inequality specifically. That's something I struggled with. Just very quickly, what advice would you have for maybe young people here in the UK or in other countries that are thinking about studying economics university and want to focus on inequality? I found that difficult. Have you got any advice for how people can go about doing that? Where they should study, what they should do?
Yeah, I mean, do it and be the change you want to see. That's my advice. And we need more people studying inequality within academia. Yeah. And, you know, it's been some progress thanks to people like Tony Atkinson, but the movement needs to grow. And so it's on all of us to contribute to that. And I think this is the direction that we're taking. It's too slow. Yeah. But this is where we're going as a discipline.
Well, I mean, just for me personally, the work that, you know, you yourself have done and the work that Thomas Piketty has done was, Thomas Piketty, of course, another very well-known French economist who you've worked a lot with. It really inspired me. I think Thomas Piketty's big book, Capital, came out, I think, in 2012 when I was still working as a trader for Citibank. And that's what is in the bookshelf next to Atkinson's Inequality book in that nice cover. And before I read that book, I didn't know that any economists were seriously looking at inequality. So, you know, the work that he's done and the work that you've done and Emmanuel Sayers, you know, a group of French economists, was really inspirational for me. So thank you for that. And you know, send my thanks to Piketty. I know you speak to him a lot. But I want to get onto your political work because you've made this big shift, which to me is super interesting because I don't see many... I mean, in a sense, it's a shift that I've made as well, but I don't see many people who are sort of top-level academics who've decided, you know what, and correct me if you don't think this is a correct description of what you've been doing, but it seems to me like you've really decided, I'm going to really shift my focus into not just, you know, writing papers and getting prestigious positions on this. I want to try and to do something about, you know, your book is called We Need to Tax Billionaires, which is quite political. Like, why did you decide, you know, I'm going to, you know, you have a very good record in economics. You know, you're a professor at a couple of very good universities. you could very easily have just written a couple of, you know, op-eds in newspapers and had a few rounds of applause. But from what I've seen of your work, you know, you've got a big presence on social media, you know, you're making videos on Instagram, you've got something like 300,000 followers on Instagram. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, I suspect that's maybe not what you imagined your life going in that direction a number of years ago. Why did you make this big shift into like, and also, you know, you have become very well known in France, that the form of taxation on the super rich, which is popular in France, is known as the Zuckerman tax, which is your name, your face. I would guess you've sacrificed a lot of, you know, your privacy for this. You know, what made you decide to take this like hard turn and really try to become like aggressively politically active?
Well, for me, it's part of the job of being a researcher in the social sciences, meaning there are different intellectual traditions, right, in the social sciences, but the tradition I feel closest to is the tradition in which the reason why we study society is not just because it exists, you know, like stars in the sky, but it's to contribute at a very modest level to improving policies and to improving society.
Yeah.
And so it all starts with a kind of research and establishing facts and understanding the problems. But to me, it seems that once you've understood those problems, when you've established facts, once you've created knowledge, it's part of the job, first of all, to contribute to disseminating that knowledge in the broader population.
Okay.
Of course, it would be much more comfortable for me to just, you know, stay in the ivory tower and just have seminars with my peers and, you know, a small group of experts. But once you've found facts about the magnitude of tax evasion, about the effective tax rates of the different groups of the population, how much the rich pay in tax relative to the middle class. These are some of the most important elements of information for our democracies. And so for me, first of all, it's part of the job to make sure that everybody knows about those facts, that this knowledge belongs to society and not just to a tiny group of experts, number one. Number two, for me, it's also part of the job to propose solutions when problems have been found. And today there is a major anomaly in our societies, which is that the super rich pay much less tax relative to their income than the rest of the population. And we'll come back to that. But once you've found problems, I think it's part of the job to say, okay, look, how can we fix that? Not with a technocratic approach, which I very much dislike, which would be like the experts have demonstrated that you need to do X, and if you disagree with that, it means you're a populist or whatever. No, not at all. But to offer solutions to feed a vibrant public conversation, a public debate. It's for people, it's for citizens to decide through democratic deliberation and the vote, but where researchers like myself can contribute is by saying, okay, there is this problem and here is a potential solution. Now we can have a, you know, there are always trade-offs, pros and cons, we can discuss that. But here is one way to do things. Maybe we didn't, we might have not thought of it exactly in those terms before, but here's a potential solution. And of course, if you propose solutions, I think it's also part of the job to try to defend those proposals, you know, because it's not enough to say, well, I think we can tax billionaires like that, and then, you know, to log off and not answer any questions. No. I think it's also part of the job to explain, well, okay, sure, you know, there are potential questions and problems, but here are the answers. Yeah. And so for me, it's really a natural part of the job, of what it means to be a researcher in the social sciences. Not everybody in the field agrees with that view. Some people think that, you know, they should not be involved in public conversation and this should be two like separate spheres.
Yeah.
But that's not how I view all of that.
Has it been difficult for you personally? People watching from outside France might not be aware that you are like really quite well known in France. And that, I guess that's happened quite quickly. Like, has it as you, I don't know, I suppose you're quite a private person naturally.
Yes.
Has it been difficult, this like sudden transition to being quite well known in the country where you live, where you're from?
Well, there are, you know, positive and less positive aspects to it. So let's say, so it's true that, you know, for my sins, this tax proposal has come to be known as a Zuckerman tax, which was not, you know, something.
Not your idea.
Not my idea, clearly not.
Okay.
What's the positive side to it? The positive side is that it forces everybody to try to understand what this is about. It's a new proposal. It's a new idea. It's not just, for instance, France used to have a wealth tax for a very long time. And it's not recreating the wealth tax. Yeah. You know, it's something else. So it has a new name, so everybody has to try to make an effort. Sometimes the opponents of the measure didn't make that effort to try to understand what this is about. Yeah. Understand.
And the difference is that the Zuckerman tax is attempting to be really tightly focused on making sure it is really the very rich, the richest people pay it, the richest people don't avoid it. Is that correct?
Yes, so there are different elements. So first of all, most importantly, it's about creating a new principle. The principle is that if you are extremely wealthy, and we can debate what it means, but I've proposed owning more than $100 million in wealth, if you're extremely wealthy, you have to pay an unavoidable minimum amount of tax each and every year. Okay, so, you know, it's trivial. You might say, well, surely this must be already somewhere in our laws, except it's not.
Yeah.
So we need to create this principle that, you know, you can't pay zero. And today, some of those billionaires, they pay zero. Yeah. Like, you know, you had revelations a few years ago by the US media, ProPublica, on the taxes paid by US billionaires.
Yeah.
And you saw people like Elon Musk, Jeff
paying
Bezos. Paying zero tax. Jeff Bezos receives a check, you know, a tax credit for his children. So that's just wrong.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees with that.
Okay.
So there has to be a floor.
So
first of all,
The
floor. So that everybody understands the proposal. There has to be a minimum. Now,
and this is on the basis that at the moment these people are paying less in percentage terms than cleaners and taxi drivers and hairdressers and teachers.
Yeah. So there has to be a minimum. Then for the minimum to be effective, it has to be expressed not as a fraction of income.
Okay.
Because the whole problem is that those billionaires,
because they have no income.
They manage to report no income, like Jeff Bezos, right?
In a technical sense. In a real sense, they have income.
From the perspective of the tax law, they manage to pretend
they're
that
redefining
they don't have income.
Their income.
Like as CEO of Amazon, Jeff Bezos didn't pay himself a wage.
Yeah.
As controlling shareholder of Amazon, he instructed the company not to distribute
dividends.
He didn't sell shares, and so he didn't realize capital gains, and so his taxable income was truly zero.
But of course,
there's no tax evasion in there.
His company is making enormous profits, but none of them, and he owns the company.
And he owns the company.
Essentially, all the money stays in this bucket, none of it comes to this bucket, so officially I have no income.
Exactly. So his true economic income is very large, it's in the billions. His wealth is gigantic, but he paid no income tax. And that's legal, and that's the way the system works, but of course, it's not a good way, it's not a good system. So we need to create a minimum. For the minimum to be effective, it has to be expressed not as a fraction of taxable income, but as a fraction of wealth.
Yeah.
Which is
because that's
much
the only way to make it unavoidable.
To manipulate.
Because they can technically reduce their income to zero, but of course they cannot reduce technically their wealth to zero.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the basic idea. So minimum expressed as a fraction of wealth. Then if you choose a rate of 2% on wealth, not a high rate, it's the rate that would ensure that the billionaires would pay as much tax, all tax included, relative to their income, than the rest of the population.
Yeah.
That's how the rate was computed. So basically, it all starts from all the, you know, a body of work, international research effort that was done over the last 5-6 years, that has established that the billionaires, the super rich, have much lower effective tax rates, tax included, than the rest of the population.
Yeah.
Especially, in particular, and that's the main reason, because of the failure of the income tax to effectively tax them.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you want to correct this anomaly, you need something, a minimum tax that's based on wealth. And so that's the proposal. And with 2%, you know, it's really low, 2%. There are many reasons why you might want to have higher tax rates than that on the super rich. Personally, I would favor much higher rates than that. Let's be clear. I worked with Bernie Sanders, for instance, in the US when he was running for president. On his tax program, he was proposing rates of up to 8% on wealth for people with more than $10 billion in wealth. You know, all of that makes a lot of sense. But my thinking here was, okay, how can we design something that everybody should agree on? You know, it's just not possible to defend the notion that billionaires should be allowed to pay less tax than the rest of the population. Mm. It's just a blatant violation of our most basic principles of equality before the law, which are at the core of our democracies. Mm. So we should all be able to agree at least on that. That was the proposal. And originally it was formulated in 2024, when Brazil had the presidency of the G20, and they wanted to put on the agenda of the G20 some new ideas for international cooperation. And in 2021, there had been a minimum tax on multinational companies that had been agreed on by 130 countries. And so I thought, well, okay, you know, let's try to do for billionaires what we've been able to do in a very limited manner, but still it exists, for multinational companies. Mm-hmm. So the idea of a minimum tax, let's do it, let's try to do it for billionaires. And then the Brazilian government said, let's do it, great idea. And so they kind of, they put it on the agenda of the G20. You know, these G20 finance ministers, they meet several times a year. Not once since the creation of the G20, 25 years ago, not once had they discussed those questions of
taxation of the very rich,
the boom in extreme wealth, which are some of the most important, frankly, issues of our time. Yeah. And so the fact that for the first time they were forced to talk about that, it kind of kickstarted the conversation in different countries. And so that's why then the French National Assembly picked up that proposal, like exactly what the, what I had formulated in my report to the G20 in June 2024, was then translated into a bill that was passed by the French National Assembly in February of 2025, minimum tax of 2% of wealth for people with more than 100 million euros.
Yeah.
And it was passed by the French National Assembly. It passed National Assembly, which is, you know, it's not a left-wing parliament. Far from it. And it passed. And then, okay, it was blocked by the Senate.
Yeah.
And so it's still not enacted into law, but it's going to come back and eventually, I'm very confident that it will end up passing because it's the current situation, which is just radical and unacceptable.
You think you will get it in France? You think you will get the wealth tax through?
Well, I'm pretty certain that it will happen in France, and more than that,
how long do you think it will take?
It will happen in other countries, and eventually it will be, I think the most likely scenario is that it will happen a bit like the creation of the progressive income tax happened at the beginning of the 20th century. So it was an international movement. You know, for centuries, the way that we did taxation was extremely unfair. It was, taxes were only based on consumption. Things like salt, you know, and commodities. And so it was a heavy burden for the poor.
Regular people.
The rich didn't have to pay taxes, etc. And so then there is this revolution, beginning of the 20th century, where different countries say, no, no, look, we are going to have a progressive income tax with higher rates for higher incomes. The UK actually was a leader because it happened in 1909 with the famous People's Budget of Lloyd George, where in 1909, Lloyd George says, okay, we are going to introduce a progressive income tax. So there was already an income tax in the UK, but at a flat rate, same rate for everybody since 1843. And in 1909, People's Budget, there's a 2.5% super tax on top of the regular income tax that's introduced for the 10,000 wealthiest people in the UK. Mm. And that's the birth of the progressive income tax. And France did the same in 1914. The US did the same in 1913. Many countries kind of did it at roughly the same time. It was not an international agreement, but it was just a common realization that we need more money for workers' pensions, you know, for many things. And the way we do things at the moment is totally unfair.
Yeah.
And so we need to make sure that the rich pay their fair share. And so, and then the income tax became much more progressive over the course of the 20th century. And my feeling is that something a bit like that
will happen.
Will happen. And it's starting to happen.
Yeah. Are you familiar much with the conversation in this country about wealth taxes?
Yes.
Because I'd like to speak about it a little bit. I think when you say that, you know, you see the wealth tax as similar to the income tax, I think that's, for me, that's super interesting. When I was writing my book, I was reading Hard Times by Charles Dickens. And they're talking at the time about taxing the factory owners. And the factory owners say, oh, it's impossible. If you tax us, we'll throw the factories into the sea. So I think if you look at history, like it shows, of course, rich people are going to fight against this. And rich people in this country are fighting against this.
That's good.
I was discussed, do you know what the Rest is Politics is?
Yes.
It's the biggest politics show in politics podcast in this country. I've been telling them aggressively that if they're serious on the economy, they should have you on. And they definitely should. But they mentioned me in their show last night. And they said people like Gary Stevenson just want to take money from the rich and give it to the poor. What do you think about that argument?
I think, first of all, what's truly radical is the current situation, where the super rich can live in their own parallel society, mm-hmm. tax-free, even though their wealth is a social creation, is a collective success. You don't become a billionaire by your own, right? You've benefited from education, from healthcare, mm-hmm. from all the public infrastructure that has made it possible for your businesses to thrive, the law courts that protect your properties, and so on and so on. And so, you know, wealth creation is always a social creation. They benefit from subsidies oftentimes. And the notion that you can become extremely rich thanks to the collaboration of millions of people and then have no duty whatsoever towards society is just, you know, totally radical. So that's the current situation.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to fix. And let me just emphasize that even though we could suspect that the super rich were not paying their fair share, and you had, you know, revelations, I mentioned, you know, ProPublica in the US, until recently there was just no hard data.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the work...
You've been doing a lot of work collecting
work.
This data. So you are convinced inequality is increasing.
And it's not it's not easy work, because there's a tremendous opacity about the super rich. There's no public official statistics about their wealth, about their income, about the taxes that they pay. And it's only by working in partnership with tax administrations in different countries that we were able to establish the facts. We have about 10 countries now where we see everywhere that the same pattern, you know, whether it's France, whether it's the Netherlands, Italy, Brazil, Norway, Sweden, everywhere, the working class, the middle class pays a lot of tax, all taxes included, roughly 40-50% of their income in VAT, in payroll taxes, in property taxes, income tax, all included, 40-50%. And then the billionaires, they pay like 20-25% of their income, you know, only half as much as the rest of the population. We didn't know that 5 years ago. Now that's established fact. Yes. So that's the first kind of novelty. And the book is really about that. It's about first, you know, telling people about this new international research effort and what we've learned from that. And then it comes in addition, to answer our question, to kind of the gigantic increase in wealth inequality, and especially in the wealth of the super rich, including in the UK. Let me just mention the numbers for the UK, because, you know, I don't think that people necessarily have that well in mind. If you look at the Sunday Times
rich list.
Yeah. It exists since 1989. In 1989, the top 0.001% of the wealth distribution, so that's roughly the 200 wealthiest families, they owned in wealth the equivalent of 5% of the UK's GDP.
Yeah.
Meaning if they spent all their wealth, they could have bought the equivalent of 5% of all the goods and services that are produced in a given year in the entire country.
Yeah.
Okay. Recently, they just released their latest numbers, their latest ranking. And now that same group of the population owns the equivalent of 25% of GDP in wealth. Meaning you have 200 families, if they spent all their wealth, they could buy a quarter of everything that's produced in a given year this country.
You're convinced inequality is increasing aggressively.
Well, when you look at those numbers, you know, it's pretty difficult to claim that it's not rising. But then, people sometimes argue, no, inequality is not increasing a lot because they look at other parts of the population. If you look at the top 10% as a whole, but here we're talking about the super rich.
So the real problem is that top, the very, very top end.
I'm not saying it's the only problem, but it's where the trend has been the most powerful, the most spectacular, and also the most worrying for democracies. Because you might say, okay, this, who cares about these 200 people? Well, you look at the media they own. You look at their influence on politics, on policies. Look, wealth for most people is it's a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. For the middle class, it's owning a home, it's pensions for your old days, it's safety, in case shocks happen, you lose your job. It's great. We like to encourage wealth accumulation by the middle class. For the working class, they don't have access to property.
Yeah.
Not yet. The working class, the bottom 50% of the distribution, almost owns no wealth. Their debts are about as high as their assets. We like to encourage access. We like the working class to have access to wealth. Okay, so we want to encourage wealth accumulation in general. Now, for the super rich, wealth is not, not accumulating billions for their old days, right? For them, wealth is power.
Yeah.
It's the power to influence the prevailing ideology. Is the power to influence markets by buying competitors, is the power to influence politics by buying elections, by influencing policy making. And there is always a fundamental tension in democratic societies between the concentration of wealth on the one hand, and extreme wealth in particular, and the very possibility of a democratic society. All the people who have written on democracy back to Aristotle, they've written about that.
So you think democracy is in threat? You think if we don't tax the very, very rich, this small group of society will amass more and more and more wealth and power, and it will take wealth and power away from ordinary people?
That's exactly what's happening, right? Yeah. It's this kind of loop where wealth begets power, which begets more wealth.
Yes.
And look at what's happening in the U.S. with, frankly, the plutocratic collapse.
Yeah, and you think
of the federal government. Just yesterday, the government announced that Trump had signed a deal with the IRS, according to which he and his family would be shielded from any tax audit for the rest of their life, because Trump, had sued the IRS. Yeah. Because his tax return had been disclosed, and he was asking $10 billion from the agency that he controls as president. And they settled on, okay, let's make a deal. You're not going to have to pay me $10 billion, but from now on, you're forbidden from just auditing my tax returns or those of my children. Look, the degree, not only of corruption, but the total, oligarchy capture of the government. And you have to also realize how fast it can happen.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people look at the US and they're like, whatever happens there cannot happen here. But no. First, it's a global trend. It can happen very fast. I've experienced it firsthand in France, the 2% minimum tax proposal, minimalistic. Everybody should be in favor. 86% of the population is in favor. And the billionaires, when it came very close to passing a few months ago, they used all the media that they own, and they own 85% of the private press.
Yeah.
They own all the economic newspapers of the country except one. And they used it to stoke fears and to predict all sorts of catastrophes, and more importantly, to essentially threaten elected representatives to blackmail them, essentially saying, look, if you vote for that, they didn't say that as explicitly, but that was really the substance of the message. If you vote for that bill, for that proposal, we will fight you with all our weapons and all our money.
I'm going to have to push you for some quick answers on the UK political situation, because I know we're short of time. Here in the UK, there is a very real possibility that we will get a new prime minister, maybe as soon as in the next couple of months, but if not, quite possibly in the next year and a half. A new prime minister is going to come in. The current government is very unpopular. The new prime minister will have to have an answer on what they're going to do with the economy. We have been pushing very hard for a number of years now that we think the UK government should be more serious about the taxation of the super rich. Sure. If the new Prime Minister was willing to do something more serious on the top end, is it practically possible, and would you be willing to support the new Prime Minister in designing and implementing those taxes such that they work for the UK economy?
Yes and yes, 100%. So, is it practical? A lot of the work that we've done over the last few years has been to study the historical experience with wealth taxation. In many countries, like France, Germany, used to have wealth taxes and abolished, in many cases, their wealth taxes. And what's important to understand is that those wealth taxes, they really didn't work very well. Okay. That is true. And that's often an argument that you hear from opponents of wealth taxation. They said, oh, it's been tried in the past and it failed. I agree with that part of the statement. That's correct. They were really poorly done. Mm-hmm. But there are two ways to look at that experience. You can say, well, we've tried in the past. It didn't work. Hence, it will never work. End of story. We can't do anything. We have to accept that the super rich live in their own parallel society, tax-free. There's not much that we can do. It's one way to look at it. The other way is to say, okay, let's try to learn about history. Let's try to learn about the mistakes that were made and draw lessons and see if there are solutions. And there are solutions. And so the two key ingredients you need to make a tax based on wealth for the super rich work well in practice are the following. Number one, you need to make sure that there is no way to avoid the tax. And tax avoidance, it's not a law of nature, it's man-made. Mm-hmm. It's when lawmakers introduce in the law exemptions or deductions. And all the wealth taxes that existed in Europe, they were written in that way. Like France, it's totally crazy. It's a story I tell in the book. In France, the Socialist Party comes into power in 1981. Mm-hmm. They create a wealth tax, and then immediately they change it to exempt the billionaires from the wealth tax. Yeah. And of course, they don't go on TV and say, look, we're going to exempt the billionaires, you know, so they invent a little story. They say that it's very important to protect business assets from the wealth tax, because otherwise we're going to harm businesses. And they define professional assets, that's how they call it. And they define professional assets, you know, that exist nowhere in any economics textbook, so they invent this notion. And they define professional assets as owning more than 25% of the shares of a company. So if you're really rich, you own a lot of shares in a big business, then all of that was exempted from the wealth tax. That's what they put in the law, right? But it's totally crazy. You know, it's like if the US was creating a wealth tax today and was exempting Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos from the wealth tax. That's what the French socialists did in 1981. But importantly, everybody understands that we can write the law differently, right? Yeah. So the idea behind the proposal is, let's start really high in the wealth distribution. So only people who have more than £100 million will be affected by the tax. But in exchange for this very high threshold, no exemption, no deduction whatsoever. Everybody understands that if you are at that level of wealth, and we're talking about 1,000 families roughly in the UK, that you have a high ability to pay taxes. And so you don't need any kind of exemption whatsoever. Now, if you write things like that, it's already a huge progress relative to the past wealth taxes. So that's number one. The second crucial ingredient is, how do you deal with the threat of migration? You know, rich people, always the debate boils down to, okay, perhaps it would be good to tax the super rich, but they're going to move. They're going to move to Dubai, to Monaco, and we can't do anything. This is wrong. Okay. It's not wrong that they will move. Surely some of them will. You know, those flows tend to be exaggerated in the public debate, but it's not zero. But what is wrong is this idea that we are powerless to curb this tax exile. We are not powerless, because any country on its own, let's take the UK, could say the following. It could say, look, if someone has lived for a long time in the UK, number one, and number two, has become extremely rich in the UK, And now number three moves to another country. That's their right. Fine. Mm-hmm. But we, the UK, we will keep taxing that person as if he or she was still a resident of the UK for 5 years or 10 years. We can discuss. Okay. And any country on its own can do that, so that there would be no incentive anymore for the super rich to move for tax reasons. And so then you might say, well, it's impossible, it's never been done. Well, no, that's what the US does. The US is even more extreme than that. The US says, if you have US citizenship and you move to another country, you have to pay taxes to the US until you die.
Yeah.
That's somewhat extreme, right? Because, okay, imagine someone who was born in the US, has US citizenship, their parents moved when they were 2 months old, then that person never sets foot again in the US. In principle, that person has to pay taxes in the US until she dies. Well, that's somewhat extreme. But what the UK and what all other countries do is the opposite extreme. Because what we do at the moment is we let people who have spent all their life in the UK, who have become immensely rich in the UK, we let them go tax-free as soon as they leave, it's, you know, crazy. On January 1st, it's totally crazy.
And it's not essential. We don't have to do that.
But we don't have to do that. Yeah. We could say, okay, look, you want to go to Dubai, go to Dubai, but from a tax perspective, you will still be treated as a resident of the UK for 10 years, let's say.
Quick one, last one. So while you're here, I really want to get the political classes in the UK to see you and hear you, because the argument for the wealth tax and wealth taxes here in the UK is very loud, very popular with the public, but many of the political classes view it as unrealistic. And The Rest is Politics, which is the biggest politics podcast in this country. Rory Stewart, one of the presenters, said that, pushed back on the idea that there is no academic consensus. He said, where are the academics? Where are the people with postgraduate degrees? Where are the professors? So what do you say to Rory Stewart, the presenter of the biggest politics podcast in the country, about the idea that no academics support this? And would you be willing to go on The Rest is Politics and show them that there are academics who support this?
Yeah, I say to Rory Stewart that he should read a bit more and listen a bit more to what's happening in the rest of the world, and he would realize very quickly that there is in fact overwhelming support even among academic economists, of course in the general population, but more importantly for your question, among economists, for this proposal. Like, for instance, in July of 2025, there was an op-ed in Le Monde that was signed by seven Nobel Prize winners.
Okay.
Who wrote, okay, we support this, it was exactly about this proposal. And 2% minimum tax on the super rich, 2% of their wealth, and they supported France doing it on its own. Don't wait for an international agreement. Lead by example, do it. And, you know, they explain the logic, you know, the failure of our tax system today to effectively tax the super rich, why that's the right approach to fixing that problem. Seven Nobel Prize winners, you know, Joe Stiglitz, Paul Krugman, Esther Duflo, Darren Acemoglu, and, you know, many others. Then in the debate in France, you had many economists who came out strongly in support. Like, for instance, the former chief economist of the IMF, Olivier Blanchard. You know, we wrote an op-ed together in Le Monde saying, and he said, that's the right proposal, do it. You know, he's not a left-wing person, he's not a communist. And so, you know, broadly speaking, you have about 80%, 90% of the population which is in favor, and you have broadly the same proportion among economists. You know, you always have 10, 20% of the population who thinks that it's normal for some people to be above the law, that the super rich, they're so kind of smart and so good, and that it's a kind of natural aristocracy, and that we have to accept that they pay less tax than the rest of us. And in any case, there's nothing we can do about fixing that, and that the law should be more lenient on the powerful and harsher on the poor and immigrants. But it's always a small fraction of the population. Most of the population everywhere wants equality before the law. And that's true for people, just like for economists. And fundamentally, this taxation of the wealth of the extremely wealthy, it's about that. It's about this fundamental principle that you cannot live in your own separate society. You have to abide by our fundamental principle of equality before the law. You have to pay at least as much as nurses and school teachers. And it's just not acceptable that you should be able to pay zero.
And you would be willing to go on The Rest Is Politics and explain that to them?
Of course, and
because, you know, I'd love for you to go on there. And I really think this is the big economic issue of our time. And I think any serious political podcast, you know, you are the world leader on this. I think they should be speaking to you. I can see we're out of time. Have you got one final message to the British public and the Australians and Americans and New Zealanders you might be watching?
Yeah, I mean, now's the time. Frankly, we are the beginning of an international movement where you have this proposal, these questions that are discussed in different countries. We need one country to lead by example, to step ahead and say, you know what? We have public finance problems. We have investment needs. We need to invest in education, in healthcare, in our public infrastructure, which is at the core of our collective prosperity. Going to do that first by taxing the super rich. It's not going to be enough, but it's necessary. And you know what's going to happen? If one country does that, it will demonstrate that you can get a lot of revenue. For the UK, we're talking about £15 billion per year from just taxing at 2% the wealth of the super rich. And the sun is going to keep rising in the morning. Okay, and then once one country does it, many countries very fast will start doing it, and that's how you create this international movement. Okay. So you know
it could be us.
It could be the UK. It can be you, and often the UK has led. You know, the UK was one of the first countries to create the progressive income tax, 1909. The UK was the first country to create the welfare state in 1945. Yeah. So now's the time to lead again.
Okay, well I hope it is. So thank you very much for your time. So Gabriel's new book, We Need Tax Billionaires, is just out now. It's very short and it's very easy to read. I read it on one flight. Like, this is just giving you all the details, basically, of how to do it and the details of how to do it. And I've been following Gabriel's work for years. He's been helping me for years. I'm really excited about getting this book and Gabriel in front of the UK political class because, you know, we can do it. And it's not just crazy YouTubers like me. It is also prestigious academics. So thank you very much. And this is Gabriel's book. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks for all your help over the years. Good luck with your work.
Good luck to you too.